some similar experience and set of emotions in our own lives. If we all shared our stories of thanks, our words would no doubt invoke memories of gratitude in others. For all its uniqueness and complexity, there is a common core to feeling grateful. We recognize a circumstance, event, or situation, even if it is a trial, as a gift. We have received some unexpected benefit. We respond with words and actions, and we become our best selves in the process. Gifts are not only pleasurable, but the right gift at the right time can change us. When such gifts arrive, we know it. Something deep within rises to the surface, that mixture of love and appreciation we call thanks. An emotion or an exchange. And then there is the office holiday gift exchange, where everyone spends a limited dollar amount on a generic gift to be exchanged for another generic gift from a coworker they may or may not like. Participation is required. Everyone must bring a gift to swap for another. The gifts are obligatory. People do not generally express deep gratitude for these presents. Indeed, the gift cards, coffee mugs, and boxes of candy are usually forgettable, and sometimes annoying or even insulting. But if someone gives you a gift, you have to give one back. That is the way it works. The idea of gift exchange is quite ancient. For eons, gratitude has been understood as an obligation to repay a favor or gift. It was defined as an exchange between a benefactor and a beneficiary. Gratitude can be formulated in this way. A, the benefactor, gives B, a gift, to C, a beneficiary. And C, the beneficiary, gives D, a favor, token, or duty, in return to A. This equation proceeds along in a line, but then arcs back to the giver in a one-direction balance of benefit. This is known as reciprocity, the norm of, the idea of doing something in return for the person who does something for you. It was a moral obligation, to use an old-fashioned term, a bounden duty. Reciprocal gratitude operated in the spheres of politics, society, and the practice of virtue. Ancient philosophers like Aristotle and Seneca speculated upon it, exploring gratitude as a divine virtue and communal necessity. To do something in return for a gift reflects appreciation for the giver and is the proper response to a benefit. Ingratitude, the failure to respond, was considered a violation of social norms. Only those ill-formed in virtue would neglect to express gratitude in a tangible way. But this system of gifting and gratitude, this quid pro quo, the Latin literally meaning something for something, was also used as a means of patronage, power, and control. I do something for you so that you must do something for me. A gift incurred a debt, and the recipient owed a response, an act of gratitude, in return. Within this framework, ingratitude was more than bad manners. Returning the favor was a duty, a requirement. Gratitude consisted of far more than personal obligation. It served as a foundation of society. Benefactors and beneficiaries existed in binding relationships built on benefits. The emperor, or king, gave his subjects the gifts of protection and provision. In return, subjects offered loyalty, homage, service, tithes, and taxes. If you failed to return the ruler's favor, such as not paying a tribute or refusing to send your son to serve in the army, you were branded an ingrate. Ingratitude was disloyalty and sometimes treason, crimes punishable by denial of favor, reduction in rank, seizure of property, enslavement, prison, exile, or death. Most pre-capitalist societies practice this quid pro quo sort of gratitude, with its complex of gifts given, debts incurred, and favors owed. In it, limited benefits flowed down from privileged benefactors to regular people, and most of the wealth flowed up from subject beneficiaries in the form of gratitude to those at the top. Gratitude was not a feeling. It was the law. Modern Western societies inherited these notions and practices. Gratitude was important and central to civic life, but Europeans also struggled with unjust and unequal structures that privileged benefactors to the detriment of beneficiaries. In the 1700s, philosophers like John Locke argued that public life and politics should be separated from gratitude. Civic relations should be based on rules and laws, not gifts, favors, or quid pro quo, with the participation and the consent of the governed. Private life, philosophers suggested, could still be ordered by gifts and gratitude in the more limited arenas of families and friends. Thus, constitutions eventually replaced kingly rulers, and laws distributed political benefits through the will of the people. Gratitude did not disappear, however. It was exiled to the private sphere, where, as one historian notes, it became a soft virtue, reserved to drawing rooms, dance halls, romances, and novels of manners. Gratitude, he says, became a sentiment. Thus, gratitude assumed the language of emotion. In the domestic realm, reciprocal rules of gifts still mattered, and benefactors still had to be honored, but feelings became increasingly important. As a result, gratitude came to be seen as a feminine virtue, something soft and sentimental that occurred mostly in the realms of neighborliness, friendship, social duty, courtship, and marriage. Most of the gratitude books on my desk make this emotive point visually. Their covers are pastel, often illustrated with flowers, with titles written in flowing fonts. The impact is one of coziness, holding forth a promise primarily for women who inhabit the domestic world. Gratitude has been feminized. I deeply distrust the language of feminization, as it often signals, especially among academics, a realm of less than. When something is feminized, it loses its intellectual bite and is relegated to mere feelings. A few contemporary intellectuals are trying to reclaim the importance of gratitude, but some of that work seems to dismiss the emotional dimensions of gratefulness altogether. To take gratitude seriously, they say, we must push feelings aside. This is odd, considering the derivation of the word gratitude. The word gratia, meaning favor, regard, pleasing quality, goodwill, is the Latin translation of the Greek word charis. Charis was the name of one of the three goddesses, collectively called the Charites, the three graces, who bestowed the gifts of charity, beauty, joy, festivity, and song. The Charites were indiscriminate givers and embodied gratitude and benevolence in the ancient world. Charis, who personified both giving and beauty, was sometimes conflated with Aphrodite, the goddess of love. Thus, even in ancient societies, it was a mistake to reduce gratitude solely to the virtue of political exchange. Gratitude was not an obligation or duty. Rather, its origin suggests gratitude arises primarily in our hearts with a sort of wildly unpredictable pleasure attending it. Classics professor David Kostin picks up this understanding from Aristotle, who held conflicting opinions about gratitude, insisting that the philosopher included gratitude in his discussion of emotions by saying that one could have gratitude. He writes, "To have charis means one thing and one thing only in classical Greek, and that is to feel gratitude." Thus, gratitude as a feeling is neither sentimental nor soft. Although gift-giving might have been appropriated by ancient rulers to enhance their wealth and power, gratitude was originally seen as part of the divine feminine, a kind of gratuitous distribution of joy, wonder, provision, and creativity, all entwined with love and beauty. Indeed, Kostin further argues that gratitude was first and foremost an emotion, or pathos, that it is a feeling in response to a favor done for the sake of others, with no self-interested motive on the part of the benefactor. Gratitude, in this mythic sense, was the human response to gifts with no strings attached, no repayment expected. In Western culture, the move of gratitude from the throne room to the drawing room might have actually, and ironically, preserved the truest nature of thankfulness as a feeling, or a complex of feelings, related to love. The right place to begin understanding gratitude is as an emotion issuing from the heart, that pulsing, mysterious place at the center of our being. The heart is not a place of clear definition or philosophical precision. The heart hides from the analytical gaze. We hear and feel its beat, but barely understand its workings. I suspect that when most people consider gratitude, they think of it as a feeling issuing from the heart. Of those 78% of Americans who responded to the survey question, "Have you felt a strong sense of gratitude in the last week?" I am sure not one answered, "Yes, this past week I entered into a reciprocal relationship of social exchange and indebtedness." Instead, I am sure the reply was, "Yes, this week I felt grateful." Indiscriminate gifts. The closest thing we have in Western societies to a celebration of the charities are the festivals of indiscriminate gift-giving, Christmas, Hanukkah, winter solstice, and the secular winter celebrations. I am a practicing Christian, and I have always loved Christmas, especially its religious aspects. When I was a girl, one of my favorite parts of the season was unpacking and setting up the manger scene, with all its figures of the Holy Family, the animals, shepherds, angels, and wise men. I felt kinship with the lovely, lithe Mary, dressed in blue and pink. But I was also fascinated by the wise men, those mysterious kings from the East. I did not know entirely what to make of them, their black and brown faces forming a compelling counterpoint to those of our white baby Jesus and his mother. The wise men wore regal robes and carried exotic gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, to an infant born to peasants in a barn. I understood one thing, however. There was no way that Jesus and his family could ever repay the debt of gratitude owed by receiving these presents. Nothing would, nothing could, be given in return. The manger scene was not a gift exchange. What must have Mary and Joseph thought? What insanity was this? They, good Jews, subjects of Roman oppression, did not receive gifts from kings. Indeed, kings took from them their freedom, hope, dignity, livelihood, land, and taxes. Maybe the whole business of gifts from the Magi made them a little afraid. The New Testament says that Mary treasured not the gifts, but these confusing things, and pondered them in her heart. No word of Joseph's response, however. I wonder if he might have wanted to give the loot back for fear there were strings attached. The story of the three kings is not only a pretty tale, it is a pretty radical one. It inverts how we think of gifts. Typically, peasants offered a gift to a king to demonstrate loyalty or request a favor. But when kings bring gifts to peasants, it turns what we think of gifts and giving on its head. It is not the case of a poor baby's parents pleading or making good with some wealthy benefactor. The baby did nothing to deserve the gifts and cannot repay any debt of gratitude. This giving of gifts reverses the normal order of things, showing not the power of kings, but the undoing of the benefactor's status and entitlement. What wonder! What surprise! Obligation is gone, replaced by complete astonishment. Repayment is neither possible nor necessary. Gifts are truly gifts, not debts to be discharged. The relief might make our hearts fill with the surprise of kind tenderness, the ache of thanks. The baby, the star, and the wise men. A story of gifts and radical gratitude. Joy to the world. Don't give me anything. Social scientists, unlike political philosophers, insist that gratitude is a blended emotion that includes awe, admiration, reverence, envy, resentment, embarrassment, and jealousy, but that it is ultimately a tender emotion. Researchers have discovered that it is actually harder for men than women to feel grateful or admit when they do feel it, especially American men. Perhaps this has to do with the history of gratitude and its being consigned to the domestic sphere during the Enlightenment. Men worked in the public world of rules and policies, whereas women inhabited the private space where feelings and practices of gratitude were retained. Eventually, this fueled a gender divide in the area of gratitude. In the 1980s and 1990s, a series of studies detected gender role stereotype traits associated with gratitude, in which men found it more difficult to be grateful because of judgments about debt and dependency and expectations of male self-reliance. In one such study, some men found gratitude to be a humiliating emotion that is best concealed. A distaste for indebtedness and a preference for independence, readily admitted by the men in these studies, act as stumbling blocks to gratitude. Although these studies focus on men, the factors they bring to light may apply to some women as well. If one sees self-sufficiency and individualism as highly valuable traits, feeling grateful can be perceived as uncomfortable, weak, and perhaps demeaning. Such feelings, while more common to men, are not unique to them. My grandmother, for example, left school early to help feed her family during the Depression, got pregnant as an unwed teenager, and struggled with a son who was both mentally ill and a criminal sexual predator. She was tough and worked hard. When she was a girl, she had dreams of becoming a teacher, but she was poor, and her local public school did not go past eighth grade. In exchange for an education, some Catholic sisters asked her to scrub floors at a local convent that ran a high school. She took up the offer. It was a genuine quid pro quo arrangement. They would teach her, and in payment, she would clean for them. But when she wound up pregnant, the sisters sent her packing. She never became a teacher, and she never trusted promises like that again. In many ways, she succeeded in life. She had a surprisingly stable marriage, enjoyed a long career with a major retail company, and nurtured her other children in relatively good ways. She too loved Christmas, mostly because she loved giving gifts. But she hated getting them. She would always say, "Don't give me anything. I don't want or need anything. And if I do, I can get it myself." These were the words of a scrappy working-class fighter, a woman who had known poverty and charity, and never wanted to be indebted to anyone again. She embodied the spirit of philosopher Ralph Waldo Emerson's observation from 1844. "It is not the office of a man to receive gifts. How dare you give them? We wish to be self-sustained. We do not quite forgive a giver." To my grandmother, self-sufficiency was the whole point of life. Achieving that was freedom. She wanted to get and stay ahead. She was fiercely proud. Gratitude was not in her playbook. A few years before she died, she had a religious conversion. After the debacle with the sisters, she did not, as far as I know, practice much of any religion. When she neared 60, however, she developed heart problems, stopped working, and found herself dependent on my mother. This did not suit her, of course, and things got very hard. Then she started reading the Bible, began talking about Jesus, and joined a small Baptist church with a quirky and kind preacher who believed in the power of salvation. It made a difference. It changed her. On occasion, I would go to church with her. She loved the sermons. She loved Bible study. But she really loved the hymns, especially Amazing Grace, a hymn she had never sung until she joined that little church. "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. 'Twas grace that taught my heart to fear, and grace my fears relieved. How precious did that grace appear, the hour I first believed. Through many dangers, toils, and snares I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home." Although a well-known and beloved hymn, when my grandmother sang it, it was as if it was brand new, uniquely her story, and tears often accompanied its verses. "Grace," she would say with great dignity, "grace. That's the whole story. That's everything." She lived a few more years, not easy ones. In the long process of dying, she had realized that life was a gift, and that even her hard-won victories came, in part, through the love and goodness of others. I never heard her say, "I'm grateful," but I know she was thankful every day she was alive during those last years, for the people she had known, for the love she had, for the beauty of her beloved adopted state of Arizona, for blue skies and sun. She had a great capacity to laugh, to see deeply, to embrace the poor, strangers, the little guy, and outcasts. The tiny Baptist church reminded her of God's love and the gifts that surrounded her. There she learned a deep spiritual truth. None of us is truly independent. We need each other, the earth, and, for her as well as for many others, God. And the thread of that interdependence is grace. The words gratitude and grace come from the same root word, gratia in Latin, and charis in Greek, as mentioned earlier. In addition to being the name of a goddess, grace is a theological word, one with profound spiritual meaning. Grace means unmerited favor, When I think of grace, I particularly like the image of God tossing gifts around, a sort of indiscriminate giver of sustenance, joy, love, and pleasure. Grace, gifts given without being earned and with no expectation of return, is, as the old hymn says, amazing. Because you can neither earn nor pay back the gift, your heart fills with gratitude. And the power of that emotion transforms the way you see the world and experience life. Grace begets gratitude, which in turn widens our hearts toward greater goodness and love. Thankfulness is a feeling in response to gifts. Together, grace and gratitude form a different moral equation. The standard model of gratitude is a closed cycle of gift and return, bound by social obligation and indebtedness, whereby a benefactor, a superior of some sort, someone wealthier, more powerful, provides a benefit for another, a beneficiary, a person in a state of need or trouble. In the closed cycle, the beneficiary is dependent on the benefactor in a way that feels demeaning or signals indebtedness. And that was surely the objection of the men in that study. This is why my grandmother found gratitude humiliating. No wonder. Few want to be on the receiving end of an unequal transaction. Although we might chafe at the idea, there is nothing inherently wrong with recognizing our dependence. Maybe a better term is mutual reliance. To be human is to rely on others. All of us are dependent every day upon the general gifts given, like the food we receive from the soil and the farmers who grow it, to more specific ones, like lunch a friend buys for you when you forgot your wallet. We should appreciate the work and kindness of others in taking care of our needs. We rely on one another, each other's work, and our shared stewardship of the earth and its resources. It is good to be thankful for these things. If we take the time to recognize mutual reliance, we feel appreciation in a positive, pleasing way. The problem arises when benefactors use their position to control others and to benefit only themselves through their benefactions. If we change a closed system to an open one, banishing transaction and substituting grace, the picture of gratitude shifts. In the closed cycle of debt and duty, the roles of benefactor and beneficiary are static, and gifts are commodities of exchange based in transaction and control. It feels awful to be stuck in such a system. Indeed, the philosopher Thomas Hobbes once referred to this as thraldom. But in an open cycle of gratitude, gifts are not commodities. Gifts are the nature of the universe itself, given by God or the natural order. Grace reminds us that every good thing is a gift, that somehow the rising of the sun and being alive are indiscriminate daily offerings to us. And then we understand that all benefactors are also beneficiaries, and all beneficiaries can be benefactors. All that we have was gifted to all of us. There would be no benefactors if they were not first the recipients of grace. In other words, gifts come before givers. We do not really give gifts. We recognize gifts. We receive them. We pass them on. We all rely on these gifts. We all share them. This is not a fulfillment of duty or a single act of kindness, but an infinite process of awareness and responsive action. The gift structure of the universe is that of an interdependent community of nature and neighbor that extends through the ages in which we care for what was handed to us and give gifts to others as a response. This is not a closed circle of exchange. It is more like the circles that ripple across a pond when pebbles are tossed into the water. Everything is a gift. In a small way, Rembrandt's story exemplified all of this. Finding a lost dog is almost always a communal effort, from strangers enlisted to look out for your beloved pet, to the neighbor who takes him in, to someone determined to discover a dog's true owner. During that hot Memphis week, my family and my little dog were utterly dependent on the kindness of others. But that dependence revealed something else, the interdependence of our neighborhood, the surprising care of people whose names we never knew, and the shared emotional experience of loving a dog. Each person in the unfolding of events that led to Rembrandt's homecoming gave a gift of some sort, and together they became a circle of goodness. Not only was I grateful that Rembrandt was found, I was grateful for my neighbors and a neighborhood that cared, people I discovered I could, and did, depend upon. Gratitude is complicated. Feelings of dependence and interdependence can be both elusive and resisted, mostly because they are caught up with soul-crushing ideas of obligation and debt. But if gratitude is mutual reliance upon, instead of payback for, shared gifts, we awaken to a profound awareness of our interdependence. Dependence may enslave the soul, but interdependence frees us. More than two centuries ago, German theologian Friedrich Schleiermacher referred to this experience as the feeling of absolute dependence. To him, absolute dependence was not demeaning. It was more like what we describe today as interdependence. He recognized that gratitude was the truest state of reality. Everything exists in an infinite relationship of gifts to everything else, and it was also the starting place for a life of meaning as our own awareness opens toward others, the world, and ultimately God. Chapter 2. Heart Matters. Piglet noticed that even though he had a very small heart, it could hold a rather large amount of gratitude. A.A. Milne. The gifts were piled under the Christmas tree. Some of the packages for our young daughter were marked "To Emma" from Mommy and Daddy. But a certain number of gifts bore a different tag, "To Emma" from Santa. Emma chose to open Mommy and Daddy gifts first, for which she happily, yet dutifully, thanked us. She saved the Santa presents. They were special. She greeted each with a squeal of delight, amazed that some mysterious stranger from the North Pole had provided such largesse on Christmas morning. Sitting in the midst of boxes and torn wrapping paper, she looked up and, with just a hint of confusion, asked, "Why does Santa give me so much? I can't even say thank you." Gratitude to a particular giver is known as targeted gratitude. We know who gave the gift, as when my daughter thanked us for her Christmas gifts, and we can respond to the giver appropriately, whether with a reply, a note, or some other acknowledgement of the gift. This is the territory of saying thank you to parents or grandparents, acknowledging volunteers on a project, or bringing a gift to the host of a party. In all these instances, there are clear benefactors, benefits, and beneficiaries, and all participants enact their particular roles in the exchange. This is what scholars call the norm of reciprocity. One knows whom to thank. Knowing from whom a gift comes surfaces an array of emotions from appreciation to humility and feelings of dependence and the obligations of debt. Benefactors may be people we know, like our parents, or those we do not. Indeed, after I graduated from college, I found myself unable to pay my rent. The situation was dire, and I asked friends to pray for me. One afternoon, when I picked up the mail, there was a letter addressed to me with no return sender, and inside was a cashier's check from a local bank for that month's rent payment. I felt the way my daughter would so many years later. I can't even say thank you. By removing him or herself from the equation, that benefactor did not want me to experience any of the awkwardness of obligation. But there was a benefactor. Even if unknown to me, I was the beneficiary, and the benefit was deeply appreciated. It was a targeted gift. I appreciated the kindness and provision, and my immediate needs were met. A second kind of gratitude, referred to as untargeted gratitude, relates to the field of grace rather than the exchange of benefit. This form is the emotional state of feeling grateful when there is no one to thank. Untargeted gratitude is usually related to life and health, unexpected good luck, or awe and wonder. Experiences like cuddling a newborn baby, finding a $20 bill on the sidewalk, or seeing a dazzling sunset. Some ethicists contend that this sort of thankfulness, where no giver is involved and no reciprocal gesture can be made, is a lesser form of gratitude. Others, however, insist that untargeted gratitude creates an emotional desire to pay it forward rather than simply to repay a giver. In the past, mostly because we could only imagine gratitude as a closed circle, we often turned untargeted gratitude toward a specific target, God. A century ago, if you survived an epidemic, God had spared you. If you found a bag of silver under a tree, God had directed you to find it. If you saw a breathtaking sky, God had given that vision to you personally. Many of our ancestors believed that God had specifically given a gift to them, an act of divine provision, in a direct and magical fashion, like a box under the Christmas tree with their name on it, signed from God. And the response? Thank you, God. Say a prayer, do a good deed for someone else as a demonstration of thanks, donate money for a new stained glass window in the church. No gratitude could ever be diffuse or untargeted in that universe. God was the heavenly benefactor, the one who gave you everything you needed and only wanted your thanks in return. This raises a host of questions, however. Why were you saved from the epidemic and not your children? What about the person who lost the bag of silver and now cannot pay the rent? What if the sky brought forth tornadoes? Did God send the storm to destroy your village? And what about the next time? If God does not heal you or pay your bills or the sky is gray, does that mean God is withholding gifts? That you are being punished? That you did not say thank you enough the last time and now God is mad? Making God a personal benefactor in these cases creates difficult questions about God. Questions that cause many thoughtful people to reject all notions of God, if not providence altogether. In the New Testament, there is an interesting verse about gratitude. Every generous act of giving, with every perfect gift, is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. James 1:17. At first glance, this verse might seem to make God the ultimate benefactor. But this is not about targeted gift giving from God, who is handing out goodies and wants thank you notes in return. Instead, every gift and every act of giving is a reflection of the light, the most diffuse of all divine metaphors. Shed upon the whole world, a light that shines everywhere all the time, accessible to all. The emphasis is on that which is untargeted, not the divine benefactor. These words echo Jesus' claim that the sun rises and the rain falls on the righteous and the unrighteous. Yes, the New Testament records some specific targeted miracles, but far more often, Jesus speaks of a wildly untargeting God, one who lavishes drunken wedding guests with even more and finer wine who throws seed around with abandon, who issues invitations to the unnamed poor to dine, who throws a party for a profligate son, and who multiplies fish and bread so that thousands might eat not once but twice. On a massive crowd, relentlessly pursuing him, he showers blessings. Blessed are the poor, blessed are those who hunger. And standing upon an ancient hill, Jesus yells out, presents for everyone. These gifts are not targeted. They simply are. They are not obligations to be repaid, rather they are gifts to be enjoyed. There are no expectations of exchange, no transaction involved. The author of James goes on to say that if you understand in your heart that gifts and gratitude are part of the very fabric of the universe, you will both be a better person and do good in the world. This is all-encompassing grace. Targeted gratitude with known givers and untargeted gratitude arising from profligate gifts reflect the emotional complexity of thankfulness. Gifts may come tagged. In that case, we appreciate particular givers and may feel happy and humble. Other gifts may come without tags, and those typically move us towards mystery, awe, and wonder. You might think of God not as a heavenly benefactor, but as the indiscriminate giver. Or, if you are not a theist, perhaps nature itself, with all of its gifts, calls forth your untargeted gratitude. Or you can respond to the gifts of human culture, learning, and science. Whatever the case, we are all untargets of gifts that surprise and sustain us. Untargeted gratitude takes us out of the cycle of obligation into the larger circle of shared gifts, beyond reciprocal exchange, toward mutual enjoyment and responsibility for those gifts. Opening our hearts to the constant flow of receiving and responding that happens around us all the time makes us more generous. A grateful heart. The seat of gratitude is the heart. Yet the workings of our hearts remain in many ways mysterious. On December 28, 2016, celebrated Hollywood actor Debbie Reynolds died at age 84. The previous day, her 60-year-old daughter, Carrie Fisher, star of the Star Wars films and noted author, had unexpectedly passed away from complications following a heart attack. A headline in the New York Times asked, "Did Debbie Reynolds die of a broken heart?" And that is a real thing. Stress-induced cardiomyopathy, known as broken heart syndrome, when people who are particularly close die within a short time of one another. Indeed, that happened to my great-great-grandparents. Married for almost 60 years at a time when few people lived so long, they passed away within an hour of each other. Broken heart syndrome. Of course, we may never know about Debbie Reynolds. Nor does the death certificate for my great-great-grandparents say broken heart. But the heart is a complex organ, necessary to all of life and susceptible to injury of both body and soul. We human beings did not always understand its biological functions, but somehow we came to celebrate the heart as the seat of emotions, conflating biological existence with the feelings that make our lives both miserable and glorious. During the last two decades, researchers have discovered real links between the heart and gratitude. Even before I was paying close attention to the subject of gratitude, snippets of these findings made their way into my field of view. An article in O Magazine, a conversation on daytime television, an interview on NPR. Most of the popular discussion claimed that negative feelings, like anger and fear, could not coexist in the same space with positive ones, like happiness and gratitude. Robert Emmons, one of the world's leading researchers on the subject of gratitude, summarizes this research from studies on heart patients. Gratitude drives out toxic emotions of resentment, anger, and envy. and may be associated with better long-term emotional and physical health in transplant recipients. Indeed, multiple studies demonstrate connections between well-being, life satisfaction and happiness, physical health, and gratitude. In heart patients who are asymptomatic, researchers found that people who were grateful slept better, were less depressed and tired, and were more self-aware and confident, with lower risks of inflammation. According to one study, gratitude is a dimension of spirituality and/or religious wellness. It suggests that gratitude interventions might lower the risk of heart disease. It seems that a more grateful heart, says researcher Paul Mills, is indeed a more healthy heart. Other studies show that gratitude promotes regular heart rhythms, rebalances hormones, reduces stress, increases relaxation, and promotes resistance to common illnesses. In addition to heart health, gratitude has also been linked to emotional well-being, lower levels of anxiety and depression, decreased panic attacks and phobias, reduced risks of alcoholism and substance abuse, and longevity. Yes, grateful people live longer. Researchers found that thankful people live happier lives as well. They are more attentive to pleasure, experience less envy, are more contented, and retain good memories of the past easily. Robert Emmons summarizes gratitude benefits as increased self-esteem, enhanced willpower, stronger relationships, deeper spirituality, boosted creativity, improved athletic and academic performance, and having a unique ability to heal, energize, and change lives. The link between gratitude and the heart are so pronounced, one research team identified gratefulness as a strength of the heart. As I read the scientific literature on gratitude, I thought back over my family's history. The generations before me had, with only a few notable exceptions, been plagued by depression, obesity, substance abuse, and heart problems. Clearly, these problems can be genetic in nature. But I also wondered if we were plagued by a gratitude deficit, a kind of hereditary ungratefulness. My mother lost her sense of gratitude as death came closer, and my grandmother struggled with gratitude in relation to poverty. Who knew how many generations had failed at thankfulness? Health, psychological, and economic problems might have numbed our ancestors to feelings of gratitude. Ingratitude might have worsened the originating issues and added more to the mix. This may have caused limited economic and personal success, which then resulted in cycles of mental illness, abuse, and poverty. In turn, those problems set up the next generation for more struggle and undermined their children's possibilities for gratefulness. My family had been on a downward spiral for a long time. Was learned ingratitude part of the puzzle? An awareness of my own family history began to dawn on me, and how it might relate to my own struggles to feel grateful. But in spite of these realizations, I felt worse. The literature seemed to taunt me. If only I were more grateful, all these good things, health and happiness, would come my way. But I just did not feel it. Not in the way that the studies suggested I should. I wanted my heart to sing with gratitude, but it was just so damn hard. None of it was natural to me. Did being born into a cycle of ingratitude consign me to a life without thanks, a heart straining toward an elusive grace? It can be hard to feel what you have not been taught to feel. Turning the train around. As a teenager, I became friends with a few high school classmates who attended Scottsdale Bible Church. My mother was horrified at the time, calling them Bible thumpers and fundamentalists. I just thought they were nice. They did not call themselves by any particular label, although Bible-believing was probably the most common way they referred to themselves. And, as it seemed to me at the time, they took the Bible and a spiritual life more seriously than did my parents' Methodist church. So hungry to know God, I broke with my family's long-standing tradition and opted to go to church with my new friends. Their world was intriguing to a 15-year-old seeker. Mostly, as I recall, they loved charts. Many of them hung on sanctuary walls and mapped the Bible in an attempt to make the mysteries of Christianity as clear as possible. In this universe of lines and arrows, where faith was diagrammed like the complex sentences of grammar class, nothing stood out to me as much as this little train. The little train has three cars. The engine is marked fact, the middle car, faith, and the caboose, feeling. Fact, faith, feeling, in that order. It was odd, in some ways, that people who urged one another to be born again and invite Jesus into their hearts would arrange life in this way. To them, the Bible taught the facts of salvation, not the feelings of such, and faith was a response to these facts. Feelings came last, if at all. Indeed, the youth pastor explained, "A train still works without a caboose, but it always needs an engine." Yes, a youth minister told a room full of teenagers to bury their feelings. "Emotions aren't important," he went on. "They come and go. God's truth is all that matters. And that has nothing to do with your feelings." I stared at that little fundamentalist train, and every fiber of my Methodist soul inwardly shouted, "No! Feelings are important." John Wesley, the founder of my family's religious tradition, had said exactly the opposite. Faith sprang from an encounter with God in which the heart felt strangely warmed. From a renewed heart came faith, and then our vision of the world changed. In effect, the facts of existence, including the fact of God, were apprehended with emotional awareness, a spiritual sense that could interpret life and purpose through love. The youth pastor had reversed the Methodist train. I looked around the room. Everyone else was nodding in agreement. Following their lead, and as the diagram asserted, I said nothing and went along with the group. After all, the pastor had been to seminary. I was a newcomer. Maybe I had misunderstood John Wesley. Certainly all these Bible Christians knew better than I did. Eventually, I learned that they believed only certain emotions were acceptable, and some feelings were downright dangerous. But happiness, submission, pleasant agreement, assurance, and conviction were all welcome. Good feelings proved that one was faithful in following God's truth. Negative feelings indicated that the faith train was going off the rails, or perhaps that Satan was driving your train. Emotions must be held in careful check to theological orthodoxy, the facts of the Bible. This embrace of the narrow range of right emotions was something I would later call orthopathy, from the Greek ortho, upright or right, and pathos, feeling. Although my fundamentalist friends had clearly defined feelings as less than, most white American Protestants, and many white Catholics as well, also live in religious cultures of emotional constraint. My Methodist parents spoke of Wesley's strangely warmed heart as part of history, but our Methodist church embodied that snarky moniker, "God's Frozen Chosen," the style of Protestantism in which decorum and order are prized above all other aspects. In white churches, expressive faith has been left mostly to Pentecostals, But those communities also theologically police emotions so as not to let things get too out of hand. Thus, gratitude as a feeling is not something easily grasped by even many religious Americans. Gratitude is mostly appreciation in announcements or thank you notes or through singing hymns. Many white churches also seem to teach gratitude as a transaction, a quid pro quo of faith. God loves us, so we must love God back. And if we do not, God sends us to hell. This is a deeply inadequate view of gratitude, one that diminishes its power as a complex emotional aspect of life. Salvation is just one more transaction in a closed cycle of gratitude. The truth is that we usually feel something when we receive a gift or when we encounter grace. All appreciation, surprise, humility, these are things of the soul that speak of our deepest needs and longings. These feelings should be neither constrained nor consigned to life's caboose. They need to be acknowledged, embraced, and celebrated. In the United States, historically, black churches have gotten this better, with expressive music and a rich theological language of blessing, where thankfulness flows as a balm in sermons and worship, creating a spiritual environment that, in effect, teaches people to feel abundance in the face of oppression, injustice, and often deprivation as a way to better know God and oneself. In non-European religious communities, the emotions of gratitude serve as the foundation of personal resilience and joy, as a soulful pathway to the truest kinds of freedom and liberation. Gratitude can be experienced by anyone, anywhere, without permission and without restraint. No external master can either release or inhibit thanksgiving. Gratitude is perhaps the most immediate and most primal of all spiritual affections, one that makes every human being a priest. Feeling grateful empowers the soul. I did not grow up in a black church. I grew up in a bunch of white ones. Maybe racial privilege blinded us to gratitude. After all, we deserved good things and success. The American dream was ours. God gave it to us. Saying thank you was polite recognition of that fact. Maybe saying thank you too profusely, however, made us feel humiliated that we were not as in control as we thought we were. Maybe that emotion made us a little bit mad or scared when gratefulness pushed against the boundaries of authority and orthodoxy. But there in church, like pretty much everywhere else in my life, feeling gratitude too deeply was a bit like a guest who overstayed her welcome. I am not a psychologist, but over the years I have learned that emotions, whether positive or negative, do not behave very well when ignored or pushed aside. A good life, including healthy spirituality, incorporates the wide range of human emotions relating to each other in ways that make each of us unique and open us to a sense of purpose and meaning. Maturity is acting in a manner consistent with our inner reality, integrating feelings with intellect and integrity. Maturity is being fearless in face of emotions and owning up to feelings denied or derided. Emotions do not tell us that climate change exists or who the president of Zimbabwe is. They are not facts in the way that scientific or historical data are. But feelings are the data that point toward our inner realities. Feelings alert us to what is unresolved in our lives, what is missing in our hearts, the brokenness that needs mending, and the relationships that need tending. When we do not feel grateful, something is blocking the feelings, and whether that something is learned or feared is important to explore. Suffering and abuse. About 2 hours outside of Lexington, Kentucky, on a narrow country road sits a small Baptist church. It embodies the spirit of rural America as much as a church can. A white clapboard building surrounded by fields and woods, with mountains in the hazy distance.